Thank you again. Still good to be here. And I should remind you, you know, you don't really have to read the books. You only have to buy them. That's really all that matters. Take care of your Christmas shopping all in one fell swoop. This talk is, of the three talks that I'm giving here, this is the one that will be most about the sort of thing that most people think about when you say ethics. Doing it again, even though I moved the mic up the way they told me to. That is to say, I want to talk about sort of particular decision-making at the end of life. I'm not necessarily going to make a lot of decisions for you or tell you how to make them, but I'm going to think about some of the issues involved anyway. And in order to do this, I mean, we can't do everything or work through all sorts of arguments about the whole range of issues that comes up. And in this talk, in order to think about decisions at the end of life, I'm going to begin with an assumption. That is to say, I'm going to assume what, in fact, Christians have, most Christians for most of Christian history have assumed, that euthanasia and assisted suicide are wrong. Okay, I'm just going to start from there. It is, of course, arguable in our society. It's something that is at issue and that people argue about. Those arguments are important, and we need to care about them. But for my purposes here, given that we can't do everything, I'm just going to leave that prohibition in place. I'm going to leave that assumption there. Christians do not and may not endorse the deliberate killing that both euthanasia and assisted suicide involve. Okay? I mean, if you want to talk about it afterwards, that's fine, but I'm just accepting that as as part of the framework within which Christians think about end-of-life decisions. The problem is, though, it actually complicates things in one way. Once we put that prohibition in place, once we accept that as part of our framework, then we're likely at some point, I mean, if we're really concerned and serious about this, we're likely to ask ourselves, well, then, does that mean that for someone, whether myself or somebody else for whom I'm responsible, does that mean that we must do everything possible to stay alive if you're not supposed to commit suicide or help someone else to do it and so forth? And if we don't do everything that's possible, and we live in a world in which a lot is possible on many occasions, if we don't do everything that's possible, are we then somehow engaged in the forbidden killing, the thing that is prohibited? I mean, that's the sort of question that's obviously going to arise then if we put that assumption in place, and that's the sort of question that I want to try to think about with you today. And in order to do that, I want to start, I'm just going to set before you four very brief kinds of cases. I'm not going to return and answer them later, though, you know, if you want to talk about any one of them, I'd be happy to. But I just want to have us thinking about the kinds of cases that are all too common in the world in which we live, the kinds of cases that raise the sorts of distinctions that we need to make and that I'm going to be trying to make as I go along, so that we have them in mind. Obviously, any of these could be developed in a lot more detail than I will. These are really just sketches. Each of them could have countless variations. That's the thing about talking with doctors about cases. They always want to complicate them in more ways. But it's just very simple, but just so that we think about some of the permutations of the kinds of decisions that we face and some of the issues that, in a couple of the cases, more advanced technology might raise for us. But here, let me just give you a few cases. Let's take the first. Let's say that I'm terminally ill with cancer. Okay, and by that, I don't mean that I'm in the last stages of dying yet. I just mean that I'm terminally ill. And you can be terminally ill and live for a while. I simply mean that somewhere down the road, say maybe you know, within 2 years or something like that, this cancer is going to kill me if something else doesn't get me in the meantime. So that's where I am right now. Tomorrow I come down with a really severe case of bacterial pneumonia, which, though severe, can be treated almost surely successfully with antibiotics. I reflect upon the fact that I might rather die of pneumonia now than go through what the next 2 years probably hold for me. And so I ask myself, or maybe I ask you, would it be all right for me to refuse the antibiotics? Go now from the pneumonia, rather than go through this couple of years. That's the first kind of case. Here's a second case. Let's say now I'm considerably older. I'm 87 years old. I've been in a nursing home for a few years, suffering increasingly from some form of dementia. And it's reached a point where I don't always know who I am, and I often don't know who you, my son or daughter, are when you come to visit me. I've come down sick. The doctors say that what I have is bacterial pneumonia, which, although I'm pretty fragile, is still treatable and possibly successfully treatable with antibiotics. The doctors suggest, though, that if you were to refuse treatment on my behalf, you're my son or my daughter and you're taking care of this, they would withhold the antibiotics. And so you ask yourself, would it be all right to refuse those antibiotics for me in that circumstance? Third case, a little different. I'm 79. I've actually grown younger. Have mid-stage Alzheimer's disease. Doing okay usually, though not always, recognize my family members when they come to see me, get the names confused once in a while. I do seem to clearly enjoy being visited. Not really clear quite what occupies me during the day, though I seem relatively contented. Often I read something. I may kind of just read the same page over again or kind of skip haphazardly, randomly, from one page to the next. Occasionally, for reasons that aren't entirely clear, I have gotten a little angry with some of the other nursing home residents, and I yell at them a little. But most of the time, I'm fairly quiet, fairly placid. As far as we can tell, fairly content. Yesterday, I had what the doctors call a Stokes-Adams episode. It's a temporary loss of consciousness due to a brief interruption in electrical impulses in the heart and the consequent failure of the heart to pump blood to the brain. My doctors say that this will happen again. Every time it happens, it will weaken me somewhat. It could eventually be fatal at some point, and it will happen again unless I have a pacemaker implanted. It's not a very hard thing to do. It will keep me, quite possibly, from dying from such episodes. Also keep me from just growing weaker. You know, it will help me live a little better in the time that I still live because I won't suffer from these repeated episodes. So the doctors ask you, my son or daughter, shall we implant that pacemaker? And then a fourth case, yeah, just one more variety. Let's say again that I'm dying from cancer. No longer now, though, in the sense that I am terminally ill and may still live a reasonably long time while terminally ill, but that I'm really irretrievably dying. And there's a difference between just being terminally ill and being irretrievably dying. I mean, you don't want me to make the judgment about which situation you're in, but doctors, granting allowance for, you know, the fallibility of human judgment, doctors have to make such judgments. What we mean by this, saying I'm irretrievably ill, is there's not really much any longer that the doctors can do to prolong my life appreciably. They may be able to keep me comfortable in various ways, but that's all. And I've now just gone into the hospital for what we all know will be the last time. We're talking days, maybe a week or two, but that's all. It also happens that I'm a diabetic. I've been taking insulin for years. And I wonder whether it would be in any way wrong for me to just stop taking that insulin now, say goodbye to you, my son, or my daughter, and drift off into a diabetic coma. And I ask you whether there's any reason that I ought not do that. Now, there you have four cases, a little variety, you know, a little different in various ways, but that raise certain kinds of issues that you can think about while I just sort of drone on about it a while. I don't think there's anything terribly unusual about these cases. I haven't picked them because they're bizarre. I picked them because I think they're unfortunately all too common in the sort of world that that we live in. For my purposes, that's their virtue, that they are quite common. And because they're common, we need to think about them and think about in advance kind of how we ought to try to reflect on them. And so, as I said, the way to think about them is, first of all, it seems to me, though I grant you I'm an academician, to think about how to think about them. And that's really what I'm going to do. I'm not going to try to answer the cases, but try to think about the framework that we need to have in place if we're to try to think well and ultimately Christianly about them. And in order to think about how to think about them, I want to first make a brief philosophical point, then a theological point, and then try to kind of set up the framework just a little bit. First, the philosophical point. We have to distinguish, I think, I mean, now understand, these are complicated questions. What I may suggest is fairly straightforward. Of course, you can spend your life working on it if you want to, though I still think that you should take it in the direction I'm suggesting, but I'm not pretending that these aren't complicated issues. But we have to distinguish between what I am going to call the result of an act and what I'm going to call the aim or the intention of an act. There are different kinds of languages that get used. That's what I'll mostly use. We're distinguishing between what one does, what the act does, and what the act accomplishes, between the aim of the act and its result. Take an example that may, I think, clarify it somewhat. A person who commits suicide intends to die. Okay? Not worried for the moment about whether it's right or wrong, just about getting our language straight. Now, you could use different terms to express this. You could say he intends to die. You could say she aims at her death. He chooses death. She, if you like a little more complicated, she embraces death as her plan of action. I mean, there are various ways that you could describe it. For all of that, I tend to use the language of aim here for what you're actually doing. But now contrast this person who clearly aims at his death with a soldier who is ordered to charge an enemy who is entrenched at the top of a hill. And the soldier may know that he faces almost certain death in doing so. I mean, perhaps all his comrades who've already started up that hill are lying at various places along it dead. But he's ordered to charge, and so he does. He does not thereby commit suicide. He doesn't choose death or aim at his death, even though he foresees that his death is the almost certain result of what he does. But he's not choosing it. We might even say, you know, thinking in certain ways, we might say that charging up that hill was just suicidal. But you wouldn't call it an act of suicide. It's not the same thing. He only foresaw his very likely death. He didn't aim at it. And if it happened, if he just happened to be the first of his platoon to make it alive to the top of the hill, he wouldn't think that he'd somehow failed in his plan of action, that his plans had been thwarted or anything like that, you see. So he wasn't aiming at death. Now, Christians have actually historically, I mean, I think this is really, I haven't presented this as a theological point. I don't think it is. I think it's just a point about analyzing the nature of action, human action. But Christians have actually historically had an important stake in this kind of distinction between an act's aim and its result. Christians forbade suicide, but they honored their martyrs. Now, you might say, how so? After all, the result, death, is pretty much the same and about as certain in both cases, suicide or martyrdom. So why the difference? Why forbid the one and not just permit, but actually honor the other? Well, it's because, at least so Christians thought, the martyr who dies rather than be unfaithful to God is not choosing death or aiming at his death. What he's aiming at is being faithful to God in some pretty difficult circumstances. He's aiming at being faithful to God while foreseeing that the very likely result of that faithfulness will be his death. But what he aims at and the result are two different things. And you can think of a more strictly medical application of it, a kind of issue that actually comes along rather commonly. Suppose a patient is in the last stages of a serious and painful illness and is being given increasingly large doses of morphine in order to control the pain, which has become very severe. Now we know, or we think we know, it's actually a little complicated, but we think we know that increasing doses of a narcotic drug may bring death a little more quickly by suppressing respiration. That's a foreseen result of the treatment. And we don't actually know that for 100% certain because severe pain might shorten death as well, and in the nature of the case, you cannot do a controlled experiment in which you leave some people without the morphine and give it to others in order to see who dies more rapidly. But even just granting the circumstances as I outlined them, this act of giving gradually increasing doses of morphine is not aimed at bringing about this person's death more quickly. I mean, you could just give such a dose that you were deliberately just going to kill him. But we're talking about gradually, you know, trying to do what's needed to keep the person comfortable while recognizing that part of the result of that may be a somewhat quicker death because of suppressed respiration. What's the aim of that act? It's to care for this person as best we can in some rather difficult circumstances. So we don't need to suppose that in giving him that morphine, we're somehow engaging in aiming at his death. We're not engaging in euthanasia, though the patient may die a little sooner than would otherwise have been the case. So that's the kind of philosophical point that I think we need clarity on, and I just don't think we'll get very far in thinking about these questions if we don't have some sort of distinction like that at our disposal. Now a brief theological point. This one does relate a little bit to the first lecture this afternoon. Wonderful as this life is, or can be at least on many occasions, and gift of God that it is, it's still the case that this is not the life we're meant to live forever. To die is part of human life, at least as we now experience it. And we can see this from a couple angles. Consider how Genesis chapter 3 ends. I referred to this, I think, in replying to somebody's question after the first lecture, but it reads, "Then the Lord God said, behold, the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil, and now lest he put forth his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever. Therefore the Lord God sent him from the Garden of Eden to till the ground from which he was taken. He drove out the man, and at the east of Eden he placed the cherubim and a flaming sword, which turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life." So whatever exactly the case might have been in paradise, and those are complicated questions. East of Eden, in the world as we now know it, the tree of life is just forbidden fruit. You see, this is not the life that we're meant to live forever. Or take the passage, and it's always, somebody will always bring it up in these contexts. Somebody asked me about it after the talk. The passage from Philippians, where St. Paul says, "For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If it is to be life in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I am hard-pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account." So that St. Paul can imagine desiring death, you see, and he can imagine that it might be preferable to his circumstances, but that's a little different thing from aiming at it, from simply taking control and bringing it about. And that's because, once again, though from a somewhat different angle than in the Genesis passage, this is not the life that we're meant to live forever, even if it's a desirable life. So that there's a good deal about a life that is often very sweet and delightful. Most of us, blessed as we are, would like more of it and wouldn't like it to end too quickly. And we should like more of it if it's God's good gift. But as I said in the first lecture, what we finally need, what the human heart finally desires, is not just quantitatively more of this life, but something that is qualitatively different, whatever you want to call it, life with God. So we're to treasure and uphold this life. We're not to aim at ending it. I mean, we don't take aim at it. But more of it, an indefinite more of it, is not our ultimate purpose. It's not what we're made for. So we need that theological point as well. And with those two sorts of points in mind, I think we can understand how Christians have thought about life and death, how thinking of themselves as what I call these strange two-sided creatures who are both finite and embedded in this world and yet also made for God, they've necessarily thought about life and death in two sorts of ways. It's never sufficient for Christians to say just one thing about either life or death, so that life is a gift of God. It's a great gift of God. But it's not the greatest good. See, what's the greatest good? Well, I don't know what exactly we want to say. Faithfulness to God and fellowship with God, something like that is what we'd say. That's why the martyr can let go of this life in order to be faithful to God. So life is a good, but it's not the greatest good. Death is an evil. St. Paul clearly calls it that. But it's not the greatest evil. What would that be? Well, it would be to lose God, see, to lose the end for which we're made. So because life is a good and a gift of God, we should never turn against it. We should never directly reject the gift. And yet, since life is not the highest good, we don't have to do everything possible to prolong it. Your purpose in life is not just to live as long as you possibly can, you see. So we may risk life or sacrifice it. in a good cause. Christians have always, you know, however puzzling it may be and however hard it may be for us to sometimes sort out the complications, Christians have always wanted to think about life and death from both of those angles. And what this means for Christians when they think about medical care is something like this. Caring for patients should never aim at their death. We should never deliberately target them in that sense. But that does not mean that medical treatment may never be refused. And indeed, though it may seem a little strange at first, and it is hard to think through, it doesn't even mean that potentially life-saving treatment may never be refused. Killing is forbidden. Allowing to die is not, in some circumstances. We'll have to try to figure out what the circumstances are. Okay? In fact, in some circumstances, allowing to die may be the best way of trying to care for someone caught in hard circumstances. Now, notice that that distinction between killing and allowing to die is built on that distinction between the aim and the result of an action. We should never aim to kill a patient. We may sometimes accept the result of their death, and that's permissible. So that sometimes, under certain circumstances, deciding not to treat is the best way to care for someone, is the right decision to make. That's just a general claim. Then, if we want to think about these questions, the question then becomes, I said, sometimes under some circumstances, deciding not to treat, allowing to die, is the right way to care for someone. So what we want to know is, under what circumstances, right? How do we know when we're at that point? How do we know when, on the one hand, I mean, in some circumstances, refusing treatment might really amount to suicide or euthanasia. I could deliberately die by refusing certain sort of treatment. I mean, the first of those four cases I outlined for you might have the look of such a case when I just didn't feel like living through the next couple years, said no antibiotics for me. Simply refusing to take a certain treatment might be a way of aiming at someone's death or choosing death for a person. See, how do we know whether that's what we're doing or whether refusing treatment is simply a permissible allowing to die, accepting the result of death, but not aiming at bringing it about? Now, the traditional language used to describe these circumstances, used to make this sort of distinction, a language that I don't much use anymore for a reason I'll mention in just a moment, but I want to start with it just because you will have heard the language, I think. The traditional language is the language of ordinary and extraordinary treatments, or ordinary and heroic treatments. That's the traditional language. I mean, the basic notion was that ordinary treatments you shouldn't refuse and extraordinary treatments you could refuse. I mean, that's about as much as people know about it usually. The problem is that the distinction in our moral tradition, the distinction was supposed to be a moral one. It was supposed to get at something, at a distinction between something that was morally obligatory and something that was permitted. But in fact, we've often read the ordinary, extraordinary language in some other ways, and it's natural that people should do that. People may take the language to point to a distinction between treatments that are sort of common and treatments that are rather unusual or rare. So you'd think that the one is ordinary and the other is extraordinary. Or they may take it to point to a distinction between a treatment that is simple and a treatment that is technologically complex, something like that. But that's not actually quite what it means as a moral distinction. See, morally, a treatment could be both rather unusual and highly complex, yet obligatory. It's possible. There could be circumstances in which that's true. And morally, a treatment could be both common, very common, and quite simple, not technologically sophisticated at all, and yet extraordinary, heroic, and rightly refusable. The language does not communicate that very often. I tend, therefore, not to use the language at all. I'll simply use some other way of talking about it, though you will still find the language used frequently, both by kind of ordinary folk and also by medical folk. I should emphasize, by the way, that what we're trying to get at here is a moral, what I'm trying to get at, in other contexts you might try to get at something else, but what I'm trying to get at is a moral distinction, not a legal one. In our society, legally, a competent adult may refuse almost any treatment. That doesn't mean that morally you ought to. I mean, that's a matter that we'd have to talk about and think about. But true, legally, you may. Whether that's a good thing about our society or not, again, that would be a larger question. At any rate, because the language has come to mean so many different things to different people, as I said, I'd rather leave that language behind and just think about the point of the distinction, what we're trying to get at. We're trying to describe the circumstances in which we may refuse treatment, even potentially life-saving treatment, and not be thought to be deliberately killing someone, okay, ourselves or somebody else. That's what we're trying to get at. So we want to know what makes a treatment what that old language used to call extraordinary, one that we may choose or may refuse, you know, but we need not accept, one that even if we refuse, we're not engaging in suicide or euthanasia. What makes the treatment fall into that category? And the answer, I think, that grows out of our moral tradition and that makes sense and that fits in some ways with Christian thought about who we are and what the end of life means is that a treatment is the sort of treatment that we may refuse without thinking that we're choosing death or aiming at death if it is either useless or excessively burdensome, either of those two things. Now, those sound very easy to say. They're rather complicated in the working out, and I want to think about each of them in turn a little bit. And you may think I've done an inadequate job of that and want to talk about it. That wouldn't be the first time someone had thought that. I might not agree with you, but still. So let's take them in turn. First, uselessness. A treatment may be refused if it's useless. Now, that seems sort of sensible. You know, I mean, nobody should be obligated to do something that's useless. But it's still complicated in several ways. Usefulness is relative to the condition of a particular patient. Many treatments may be helpful, even life-saving for some patients, but of no use for others. So that it's not as if we've got these two lines on the piece of paper, and under this one we put useful treatments, and on that one useless treatments, as if they applied across the board. No, it will vary from patient to patient. And even more important, once a treatment has progressed to a new stage, the situation may change. A treatment once helpful for a particular patient may cease to be helpful at a further point down the road, and we don't want to get ourselves trapped into thinking that because we once started it, we may, you know, we're stuck forever, that we may never stop it. And this is especially important when a person is in the very last stages of dying, what I call irretrievably dying. Because for someone who is irretrievably dying, almost all treatments are likely to be useless, you see. There may still be things, as I said before, that we can do to help keep that person more comfortable and to care for them in various ways. But if we're thinking of treatment as curative in any way, by definition, if we've said the doctor's judgment is that this person is irretrievably dying, then most everything that we think of as curative is no longer useful. Now, when we speak of irretrievably dying, we mean, first of all, I think, a matter of time. And that's the way I described it before. I said days, you know, maybe a week or two. And that certainly is true. It'd be strange to call somebody irretrievably dying who might live 3 years, for instance. They could be terminally ill, but irretrievably dying would be a peculiar way to describe it. So the time makes a difference here, but I think it's important to see, in order to see what sort of we're thinking about here, that it's not just time that's involved. It's the effect that time or the lack of time has on something else, on the range of what I call life choices. Because remember, we're not supposed to choose against life. We're supposed to choose life. Okay, we're not supposed to aim at death. Okay. Now, what the narrowing of time does is it means that there's also a narrowing of the range of life choices that's available to someone. See, if you think about those kind of cases I described, when I'm terminally ill with cancer, but the doctor says, well, you know, you might live 30 months before you actually die from this, I still have a fairly wide range of choices left to me, and they may actually make a difference in how long I live. I can stay real close to home, never leave, you know, my doctor's side, take a lot of supplements, drink blueberry extract, you know, do all sorts of things, stay alive as long as possible. I might also say, well, you know, I've never seen the Cleveland Indians in spring training, and I've wanted to do that most of my life. I'm going to do it even if it wears me down and I die a little sooner than I otherwise would have. I mean, those are different life choices. Okay? So that from among the possibilities that are available to me, I can choose some options that keep me alive as long as possible. I can choose other options that might mean a somewhat shorter life, but that give me a chance to realize some other good, some other goal. It's not that I'm trying to die more quickly. It's that I'm choosing a certain kind of life. I'm making a life choice. I'm choosing a life that may be a little shorter than some other choices I could make, but I'm aiming at life, not aiming at death. I'm still choosing life. Now, for the patient who is irretrievably dying, that range of life choices has narrowed dramatically because there's not much time. It's related to the time issue, but because there's not much time, because few, if any, treatments can be helpful, useful for such a person any longer, there just aren't many life choices next left to be made. If I've never seen the Indians in spring training, we'll have to hope that somebody in heaven cares about that because it's not going to happen any longer here. And as I said, at this point, continued attempts to cure such a person not only are not required because they're not useful, they may even get in the way of attempts to just care for the person and comfort them as best we can. At any rate, nobody is morally obligated to pursue treatments that are not expected to be helpful. And to refuse such treatment is not necessarily choosing death or aiming at death. It may be simply the refusal of a treatment, not the rejection of the gift of life. The choice of a certain kind of life, it's not killing, it's allowing to die. Now, you know, those are enough complications. As I say, it's not quite as simple as just saying useful, useless, something like that. But we can see that, and I hope it makes a certain amount of sense as I've tried to sort it through. Any guideline, however clear, is capable of being abused, however. And moralists actually are the best at figuring out sophisticated ways to abuse them, but all of us are pretty good at that on certain circumstances. And this first criterion can certainly be abused. I'll give you an example of it. Consider the case of a baby who is born with Down syndrome and with an obstruction of the esophagus. Not at all, actually, not all that uncommon. There have been some famous cases of this sort over the years in this country. One such case actually was could almost be said to be the case that was the thing that first generated some of the bioethics movement in this country. At any rate, in order for such an infant to be fed, surgery will have to be done to remove that obstruction in the esophagus. And we would surely, for what we might call an otherwise normal child, I mean, this is tricky language, but let's just accept, for what we might call an otherwise normal child, we would surely do the surgery, no question. About it. Yet there have been cases in which parents upheld by courts have refused the surgery, have refused to do the treatment for the infant. And so, see, then we have to ask ourselves some questions. If you read, say, a newspaper article about such a case, I can tell you what it says. It says, I mean, it may talk about the conflict a little bit and so forth. Maybe the hospital went to court or whatever, but it'll say the parents refused the treatment in order to allow the child to die. That's what it will say. What we have to ask ourselves is whether that's the right use of the language or not here, you see. Has the child simply been allowed to die? Has a useless treatment been set aside and foregone in order to allow the child to die? Or have those responsible for its care actually taken aim at its life, you see? Have we decided we're not going to do this so that it dies? If we were the parents who had refused the surgery, how would we formulate our plan of action, to use that cumbersome phrase of mine? Are we actually saying we will not do this surgery so that this child dies and doesn't live the life that it has? If so, then it might not be right to describe what we're doing as allowing to die. So the usefulness, uselessness criterion is pretty straightforward, relatively simple, but it can get complicated, and it can be tricky. See, the question is whether we're making a judgment about the usefulness of a treatment or the usefulness of a life. Useless treatments may always be refused. Of any possible treatment, we have to ask, will it benefit the life this patient has? That's different from asking, is this a beneficial sort of life to have? Is this the sort of life I'd like to have or I'd wish for someone else to have? And if If we're asking the second question, if we're not saying, will this treatment benefit the life the patient has, we're saying, is this a beneficial sort of life to have, then it's clear that if we refuse the treatment, we're not just taking aim at the treatment. We're taking aim at the life. And should not, if we really want to think clearly and speak carefully, call that allowing to die. Though we call it allowing to die all the time in our society today. So that's the first thing that makes a treatment what used to be called extraordinary, the kind of thing that may be refused that no one's morally obligated to take, if it's useless, understanding all the sort of complexities of that I've tried to sort out. The second reason, which if anything is even harder, I think, in some ways, in addition to uselessness, is that treatments may be refused if they are excessively burdensome. Okay, and what makes this even more complicated is that, understand, we're saying that treatments that are useful, perhaps even, I mean, we have to think about the circumstances, but perhaps even life-saving, could, under certain circumstances, be excessively useful. Remember, you do not have to do everything possible to stay alive as long as possible. None of us is morally obligated to do that. As I always say, with perhaps apologies to someone who may be out there, this would be a world of all librarians and no soldiers. And, you know, that, we don't have to have that that sort of world. Apologies to any librarians out there. But life is not our God. Okay, so we need not accept all burdens, no matter how great, just in order to stay alive. Now, sorting it through and thinking it through, you know, will be very complicated on different occasions. But at least as a general statement, that's true, I think. Now, we need to recognize what this means. It means, as I said, that we might rightly refuse to not be committing suicide or engaging in euthanasia or anything like that. We might refuse even useful treatment that would prolong life for a significant period of time if that treatment really did carry with it significant burdens that we just, you know, weren't prepared to choose. And we were prepared to choose a shorter life without those burdens. See, and here is where some genuine freedom and permission enters into the moral life, including the Christian moral life. You might choose a longer life that has with it those burdens of treatment, for whatever reasons, to draw you in that direction. I might choose a shorter life free of those burdens. Neither of us necessarily chooses wrongly or, you know, does something that's wrong. Indeed, it's also possible, as I would think occurs to you, that we might make different choices at different stages of our life. The choices I might make, the burdens I'd be willing to accept to stay alive when my children are young, might be different from the burdens I'd be willing to accept when they're grown, for instance. There's a realm of genuine sort of permissibility here in which we do not all have to make the same choices. We can still be choosing life, but choosing shorter or longer lives, burdened with certain things or not burdened with those lives, just as some of us choose to be soldiers and others to be librarians. So that to reject or to withdraw treatment because of its burdens can still be a refusal, not of life, but of treatment. So that from the various lives available to a person, some longer, some shorter, some more burdensome, some less burdensome, we choose one life in particular, but we still choose life if we're thinking rightly about it. Just as that soldier going on that sort of suicidal mission does not choose to die, but rather to live in a certain way, rather nobly and heroically, but not very long, probably, and recognizes that to live in this way is probably not to live very long. So also the patient refusing what he or she finds to be an excessively burdensome treatment still chooses life, one particular life among the several that are still available to that person. Now again, this criterion can still be abused. The simple fact that I announce my choice and that I say there's a real realm of permission here in which we may choose differently doesn't mean that you just have to accept it. I mean, if I've just gotten diagnosed with that bacterial pneumonia and the antibiotics are available and I'm 35 years old and otherwise have been in good health and I say, you know, I just don't like needles, it's excessively burdensome, well, I think you ought to talk to me about that, you know. I don't think you shouldn't just say, well, Mylander said that excessive burden is a reason that it's permissible to refuse treatment. He finds needles excessively burdensome. Ergo, you know, it must be okay. No, we don't, you know, we don't, I mean, perhaps legally, perhaps, although actually I should have said earlier, I said a legally a patient may refuse anything. I should have said, I don't know if I did, a competent legal patient. If I really went on about needles, maybe you'd start to wonder about competency there. But I'm not saying that that we have to just accept at face value these. But it is still the case that people may make different choices. I am actually astonished sometimes at the burdens that some people will accept in order to live longer. Now, I don't know. I mean, maybe when the day comes, I'll accept them too. It looks a little different in the moment, I understand. But some people endure just enormous burdens in order to stay alive. And it doesn't seem to me, looking at them, that I'd want to make the same choice. But I mean, we don't know for sure what we'll do, but certainly there's a range of possible permissible choices there. We could abuse it, as I pointed out. More like, I think the more common way, this criterion can also be abused, and I think is sometimes, in the case of certain patients. The severely demented, the permanently unconscious, the profoundly retarded or disabled, all sorts of lives that do not appeal to us. And you know, I understand that. I'm trying to be careful about my language, but I understand what people mean. These are not lives that any of us would choose for ourselves given alternatives. That doesn't mean that we should get rid of them, but they're not lives that we would choose for ourselves if we had the possibility of choosing. And in the face of people who have such lives, we may sometimes be tempted by the thought that their lives are a burden that is not worth continuing. But again, we need to try to think clearly, and we need to try to be honest with ourselves about what we're thinking. We need honestly to recognize that if that's the reason we reject treatment, not because we think that some treatment for this person is so burdensome, but because we think that having that sort of life, being profoundly retarded, say, is itself severely burdened, then we are rejecting not just treatment, but the life. That's what we're choosing against and aiming against. And we have ceased to try to care for that person's life as best we can in the time and place that he has been given. So that again, we need to be careful. We need to recognize that these sorts of distinctions can be abused, and that not just that somebody else may abuse them, but that we ourselves, especially tempted by tough circumstances, are likely to be drawn to abuse them in various ways. But this is what I called thinking about how to think about these end-of-life cases. Aside from just hinting a little bit about what I thought about a few cases, I said I haven't tried to tell you how to make these decisions. I've simply tried to think about kind of what framework we need to have in mind if we're going to try to think well and clearly about these. If we're going to start by accepting the Christian prohibition of suicide and euthanasia, but not suppose that that means that, therefore, we must do everything that medicine is now capable of doing. How do we think, then, about these decisions? A framework, something like this, is what I think we need. And I wanted to end just by reading you a passage. I've used it a number of times because I just think it's such a nice passage. It's by a guy named David Smith, who's retired now but taught at Indiana University for quite a while. And Smith wrote his nice little paragraph about what it means to be a good host if you're hosting a little gathering or a party or something like that, hosting the people who are in our care. He writes, "A couple invite friends to dinner. Food and drink are pleasant. The conversation bubbles. The good host is hospitable and courteous to his guest, no matter what his shifts in mood. But there comes a time when the party winds down, a time to acknowledge that the evening is over. At that point, not easily determined by clock, conversation, or basal metabolism, the good host does not press his guest to stay, but lets him go. Indeed, he may have to signal that it is acceptable to leave. A good host will never be sure of his timing and will never kick out his guest. His jurisdiction over the guest is limited to taking care and permitting departure." And I think that captures it just about right. Thank you very much.